I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Most of us are having a running conversation with ourselves as we go about our lives, whether speaking silently or out loud. And it's not necessarily a sign of mental illness. Rather, we're learning that self-talk or inner speech is one of the ways we use to solve problems, manage our emotions, even set goals for ourselves. So how does this inner dialogue work? Who is the self that we're talking to? What about the words we use? Are we nice to ourselves or a critical taskmaster? Do we use first-person or third-person pronouns? And how do you go about studying these internal private mechanisms? Well, today on Radio Times, we're talking about talking to ourselves, and we have two guests who have joined us. Charles Fernyhough is a professor of psychology at Durham University in the UK, author of a number of books, including The Voices Within, The History and Science of How We Talk to Ourselves. Charles Fernyhough, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, thanks for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. And joining us from the studios of the University of Michigan is Ethan Cross, professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, director of the university's Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory. Ethan Cross, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, great to be here.
Charles, let me begin with you. I'm assuming that we are all talking to ourselves all the time, whether we are aware of it or not. Is that true? Not true. Or
well,
do we know?
A lot of people would say that it's true from their experience. If you ask people this question, a lot of people will say, yes, I'm doing it all the time. And, you know, philosophers have been interested in this for centuries. And some philosophers nowadays have said, you know, inner speech or private speech, when we talk to ourselves out loud, they're kind of universals of consciousness. We're doing it all the time. But actually, when you dig a bit deeper, you find that self-talk probably isn't as common as we think it is. The trouble is, it's a very hard thing to study.
Sure. I mean, do you think that there are people that do not do self-talk?
If you'd asked me that question 10, 15 years ago, I probably would have said no. But I've actually worked with some people who seem to do very little self-talk. And we need to distinguish between two main kinds. Mm-hmm. There's the silent stuff that goes on in our heads that nobody else can hear. And we call that inner speech. And then there's another kind that we do out loud. It's the same kind of speech in many ways. We call that private speech or overt self-talk. And, you know, most of us probably do one or the other right. A lot of the time. But I think there are some people who just don't think in that way.
How do you see this, Ethan Cross?
I agree that there's a lot of variability across people in terms of their awareness of whether they're engaging in these different kinds of inner or outer speech that's directed to the self. Interestingly, when I give presentations on this work, I'll often ask the audience, how many of you talk to yourselves at times? And a good number of people raise their hand. Usually they're pretty happy I ask that question because it makes them think they're not crazy, as I think you intimated to start. But there are always a few people who don't have any recollection of that experience, which I think speaks to what Charles is saying. It is a very tricky experience to study, and one of the questions I think from the scientific point of view is: are the methods we're using really capturing self-talk well when people do this as they live their lives? My intuition is that it's quite common in terms of the internal speech. I forget the term Charles, what term did you use to, what's your preferred?
Internal, I would say inner speech, but inner there speech. Are a lot of different terms out there.
Yeah, I think inner speech is quite common. I think vocalizing that out loud, there's a large dip in terms of how frequently that occurs. But no question, people are going to vary on this.
Let me go back to you, Charles. How different is either inner speech or private speech? How different is that from just plain old thinking? Or is it?
Well, the way I would put this is that thinking is a really big, broad term. In fact, I think as psychologists, we should try and avoid using it. I know I just used it. It's a really hard word not to use.
It is. It's hard to get around that.
We can try and be a bit more specific, particularly when we're doing things scientifically. We can try and focus in on different kinds of thinking and talk about them. So one way of putting your question is to say, do we need language to think? And the answer to that is clearly not. You know, your average 12-month-old baby who doesn't have any language can do all sorts of incredibly intelligent stuff. And the same applies. You know, we're going to hear about dogs later on in the show.
Right.
And, you know, dogs can do some really clever things, and they don't seem to have the kind of language that we have. So it's not that you need language for thinking. And I think that's a dead end. I think that question that's been raging for centuries is just doesn't get us anywhere. The way I would like to see it is that if you have language, if you can use your language, if you can sort of turn your language back onto yourself, maybe you can start doing things that otherwise would be a bit harder to do. Maybe language is a tool that can help us to think differently, help us to think more effectively, help us to think better.
Well, Ethan, let me go back to you then, picking up on what Charles just said then. If many of us do this, why and how can it be helpful? And is it a matter of making those sort of unconscious, sort of loopy, errant thoughts, making them more conscious and directed?
Yeah. So first of all, I think that the distinctions that Charles is raising are great. And, you know, in our studies, we take as our starting point that we are dealing with language and we're dealing with instances in which people are aware that they are essentially talking to themselves in different ways. You know, so how do people use language to their betterment? Can I tell you a little bit about how I got interested in this
Absolutely.
Topic? 'Cause I think it might set this up well.
Sure, perfectly.
I was doing things like listening to shows like this and watching television, and I and my colleagues would see people do these kind of strange things. Like at times, particularly when they were stressed, they would refer to themselves using their own names and other non-first-person pronouns. So one memorable example was LeBron James 8 years ago. So not this most recent free agency, but two cycles ago.
Right. I hear you.
You know, it was a very emotional decision for him, and he went on TV and he said, you know, I wanted to take this decision about where to go seriously. This was an emotional decision. LeBron James has got to do what is best for LeBron James. Kind of strange, right?
In the third person.
Fast forward a couple of months or years, Malala Yousafzai, youngest person ever win the Nobel Peace Prize, tells a story about what she thought and what she did when she discovered that the Taliban were plotting to assassinate her. And what she says, this is a Jon Stewart interview, you know, I thought to myself, what would I do if the Tali came to kill me? And then I said, if he comes, you'll just take a shoe and you will hit him. You will not let the Tali take over, and so forth and so on. And so there she's doing something also a little strange. She's using the word you,
right?
A second-person pronoun that we virtually exclusively use to think about and address other people. And so that got us thinking about how people might be using language, to use Charles's quote, as a tool, or how they might be weaponizing it to help themselves cope with stressful circumstances. And it's led us to do a series of studies where we essentially bring people into the lab or study them out in the wild as they live their lives, and we see, does it make a difference whether you reflect on what you're feeling in the first person, as we normally do,
right,
or using the language of others, right, name, second and third person pronouns. And what we find is that shifting from the first to the second or third person can be quite useful for helping people perform well under stress, reduce how distressed they feel, and so forth and so on.
Because it distances themselves, in a sense, from themselves?
That's right. One of the things we know from decades of research is that it's often a lot easier to coach other people through their problems than it is to coach ourselves. And many people have this reaction. A friend comes to you with a problem, they're ruminating, they're anxious, they're upset, they can't see the solution, they present the case to you, and you can coach them through it.
Okay.
But it turns out when that's happening to us, big problems. What we think is going on is we think people people recognize at some subconscious level that language provides a means of allowing us to think about ourselves like we were someone else. And that provides us with distance that can be quite useful for managing stressful and intense emotional situations.
Well, Charles, let me go back to you because I think both of you have looked at this, and I think we often think we're having this monologue with ourselves, but we are multiple people. It's not that we are have multiple personality disorder or anything like that, but we are many people, and help us understand that connection between that and the conversations we have with ourselves.
Well, one of the things that the lovely work that Ethan and his colleagues have done is that it shows what I think is one of the key things about where all this stuff comes from. And my inspiration, what got me into this topic in the first place, was the writings of the Russian psychologist Lev Vygotsky, who was working in the kind of 1920s, 1930s, before his untimely death. He argued that these words in our heads, this inner conversation that's going on is actually a kind of conversation, and it comes from real conversations. It comes from the conversations we have with other people, particularly when we're growing up. So when you ask that question about who talks to themselves, if you ask your average 5-year-old kid, the answer is going to be yes. If you walk into any, you know, playgroup or nursery school anywhere in the world, you'll find little kids talking away to themselves the whole time. And Vygotsky thought that was significant. What Vygotsky argued is that we start off talking to others. We use language for all the varied purposes that language has, including getting other people to do stuff. And then in time, we start to turn those words back on ourselves so that we can control our own behavior. We can regulate our behavior and our emotions and do all sorts of other cool stuff. So what that means, and what really got me fired up as a young psychologist quite a while ago, is the implication that conversation with ourselves really is a conversation. It really has the structure of a dialogue. It has the to and fro, just as Ethan shows. You talk to yourself as if you're another person. And that seems to give our cognition, our thinking, if you like, some really special properties. And we've started from a situation where people tended to think that inner speech was just one thing. We've started to trace the different forms that inner speech takes. So many people, for example, will endorse the idea that their inner speech is like a dialogue. We've been able to study how dialogic inner speech works for the first time, including getting a glimpse of how it works in the brain.
And we're almost up on a break here, but are you saying that when we talk to ourselves, that there are many selves that we are talking to?
I think so, yeah. I think the idea that we are fractionated, we can take different positions, we can take different positions to our own selves, we can have internal conversations with other people who may or may not exist, who may or may not still be alive. We can do all of those things. We're not just this solitary voice kind of churning out stuff hour after hour. We are multiple.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Sounds like you want to say something as well, Ethan and Charles. Had to jump in there. Charles Fernyhough, professor of psychology at Durham University in the UK. Ethan Cross, a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, talking about self-talk, our inner dialogues, how we talk to ourselves. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're exploring our inner and outer dialogues, why talking to yourself has benefits. And again, our guests are Charles Fernyhough and Ethan Cross. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm thinking, though, about the kind of conversations that we do have with ourselves if we're aware that we do this. And sometimes they are, you know, I'm a failure. I can't do this. This is too hard. Sometimes it is, you can do it. Buck it up. You know, you're smart. You can handle this. And I wonder, Ethan Cross, just how important either the positive or the negative self-talk that we have, how influential, how much of an impact that has on our functioning, how we think about ourselves, even live our lives.
Yeah, we find that it's quite important. You know, some people have used the colloquial phrase inner critic versus inner coach to capture, I think, the dynamic that you're describing. And what we see in our studies is that when this kind of inner critical voice comes up, which often tends to take the form at least in our studies, of people talking to themselves in the first person. I can't do this. How am I going to do this? What am I going to do? That can be quite problematic. That can make it really challenging for people to follow through with their goals, whether they be goals to perform well in a game or just control their emotions more effectively. But switching, in our studies, the switch is usually from the first to the second or third person. We call it distant self-talk. That changes the tenor of the conversations we have with ourselves. It leads us to be more supportive. It leads us to think about stressful experiences less as threats, situations that we can't handle, and more as challenges. Right? I'm thinking about what I've got in front of me. I can deal with this. That doesn't always mean it's a lovey-dovey voice of "you're so great" and "you're the best psychologist in the world" or what I'm projecting here. But it means get your act together. You can handle this. You've done it before. And we actually see that transition when we do these thought scans where we try to have people write down the thoughts that are streaming through their mind as they experience them. And you see the different forms that these conversations take as a function of the language they use to reflect on themselves, which is quite powerful.
Let me toss the same kind of question to you, Charles. Does it matter what we say to ourselves?
Sure. And, you know, language has all sorts of different functions. We can use language for all kinds of different purposes, and we can turn many of those purposes back on ourselves as well. So just as Ethan has said, there's a real negative side to self-talk. You know, we can spend a lot of our time beating ourselves up in language, but we can also do really positive things. You know, we can make ourselves laugh, we can encourage ourselves, we can guide ourselves and plan stuff and so on. So I think the way to think about it is that language is this incredibly rich, powerful, multifaceted thing. And when language is turned on ourselves, it has just as much richness and just as much capacity to do different kinds of stuff. But it is worth bearing in mind that there is a negative side to it. And negative self-talk can be a big feature of some, you know, really quite difficult and unpleasant conditions.
I'm thinking about who that critic might be. I mean, who the voice of that critic might be for someone. And would that be a critical parent, do you think, Charles?
Well, I think there's an obvious connection to make between Vygotsky's theory, which says that all this stuff comes from internalizing conversations with others, to go from that to say actually what you've done is you've internalized this, you know, aggressive parent or this critical parent. And I'm sure some of that goes on, but I would say most of my focus has been on just how you take on the structure of a conversation that allows stuff to happen rather than, you know, I don't feel that my own inner speech, for example, is me, you know, having a conversation with a particular other person. You know, I think those people come and go in my inner speech. And as I said, I can talk to myself, I can talk to my mother, I can talk to somebody who died a long time ago, I can talk to somebody, an imaginary friend, I can talk to God, I can talk to, you know, anybody who can take up that place in my internal conversation, I can have a conversation with.
I mean, that sounds like a very directed conversation. I'm also thinking about when those thoughts are just flowing through our heads, whether they're words or images or memories, and just maybe they don't hang together, sort of a, you know, a garbage bin of ideas. What do you think about that, Charles? I'll toss that to you, Ethan.
Well, I think language has a particular role. I think it's hard to prove the point, but I suspect that language has a particular role in threading all that stuff together. So I like to think of inner speech as like the thread of a necklace that holds the different pieces of the necklace, the beads or whatever, together. So it holds together those visual impressions, it holds together the memories, the thoughts about the future, all this stuff. Language kind of knits it all together. That's a hard thing to prove, but there are a few pointers to suggest that that might be the case.
What do you think, Ethan? And this is hard to talk about because in so many ways it's so subjective and it's so unconscious.
Yeah, and even harder to study. You know, as Charles mentioned before, not all thinking is linguistically based. And so memories often pop up in the mind as just a visual snapshot. And so what I find useful is taking as our starting point that there is some awareness of language being present, that I can recognize that I'm having this thought, right? I'm thinking, using words in this particular way, and that's where we get going. Now, oftentimes that involves memories of the past and anxieties about the future, but it doesn't always, those kinds of thinking about memories and imagining the future. I can imagine the next vacation in the Caribbean down the road, whenever that might happen, if it ever happens, and not have a word be attached to it, just an image of a coral blue sea. And that wouldn't constitute, in my mind, an instance of self-talk or a conversation.
Because it's visual? It's not...
Yeah, because the linguistic piece isn't present in that way.
Do you think, Charles, though, that those more unconscious conversations that we have, that they happen at a different speed than the conversation that you and I are having right now?
Well, I'm not sure about where consciousness comes in. I mean, I think everything we're talking about really is conscious, but I think maybe what you mean is the way that these thoughts are motivated. So often we seem to find ourselves on a spontaneous train of thought that doesn't really come from anywhere, it doesn't seem to go anywhere, and that's really important. It's important that we think about how that works, and I think inner speech has a role to play in that as well. But in
go
terms
ahead.
Of... Sorry.
No. Go ahead, and then, Ethan, I'll let you jump in there. Just finish your thought, Charles.
Yeah, in terms of whether inner speech can kind of tie all this together. I mean, one really interesting way to look at it is to ask, what happens to you if you're used to using language and you suddenly lose the ability to do language because of some sort of brain insult, because of a stroke and so on? And there are a few little sort of tantalizing bits of evidence suggesting that it has a big effect. Losing your language, therefore losing your ability to do self-talk, has a big effect on who you are. And the famous example of this is the case of Jill Bolte Taylor, who wrote about her life after a stroke from which she recovered. And she argues that when she lost her language, she lost her ability to talk to herself, but she also lost some sense of who she was for that period of time that she lost her language. So that fits with the idea that language, that inner speech, helps to kind of pull it all together, helps to sort of be the thread of the necklace, allowing all these different kinds of experience to cohere into a kind of narrative.
Ethan, you want to add to that?
No, I think that was great, actually. I was going to pivot. Can I pivot?
You can pivot. Yes, please. Pivot away.
I would love to hear everyone else's thoughts on this. We've been surprised about, in studying this over the past several years, there's been one really surprising finding, which has to do with the effort and the ease through which people can benefit from using language as a tool to control themselves. One of the things we know about self-control and emotion control is that it typically is challenging to do. When we experience anger or depression or anxiety, it can feel effortful to try to rethink the situation to feel better about it. And there's oodles and oodles of evidence suggesting that that is exactly the case. But what we saw happening in our studies is that after the studies were done, we'd ask people informally, how easy was it for you to use your name or use you to think about this stressful experience? And people would report, hey, it was really easy. I just slipped right into it. And the benefits were accrued. We've since done other studies, brain imaging studies, where we look to see if you tell a person to use their name, use this distant self-talk to think about a really stressful experience, does that recruit effortful control centers in the brain regions or networks that consume lots of resources in order to clamp down emotional responses? What we find is that, unlike lots of other strategies, these distance linguistic shifts don't, which I think is really intriguing. And it raises the question, why might this represent such an effortless tool? And I'd love to Charles, I don't know if you've thought about this. I clearly have, so can keep going. But I'd love to hear what you think about that.
Well, let me just ask you just a quick question there.
Yeah,
sure. Are you saying, Ethan, that when we switch from the first person to the third person, that activates a different part of our brain?
Yes, it does activate different networks in the brain. But just to clarify, what's really interesting about it is that when you're in this third-person mode, you're not recruiting these networks in the brain that consume a lot of energy, if you will, to function, which is what typically happens when you ask people to control their emotions using other kinds of strategies. Like if I were to tell you, try to become a detached observer as you think about this problem that you're experiencing. That instruction can lead people to be more objective and to feel better, but it consumes a lot of energy, a lot of resources. And what we find is that you get the same outcome with the first to third person switch, but without the same level of energy consumption or effort consumption.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Ethan Cross. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, director of the university's Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory. Charles Fernyhough is a professor of psychology at Durham University in the UK. He's written a number of books, including The Voices Within, The History and Science of How We Talk to Ourselves. And that's what we're talking about on Radio Times today. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I want to just jump in here and actually ask you, Charles, what, though, can we learn from people who do, I don't know if hallucinate is the right word, but, you know, to hear voices for some people is a form of psychosis, but what can we learn from them to help us understand the voices that we hear?
So, people, you mentioned right at the start that there's this kind of, you know, suspicion about talking to yourself, that it's the first sign of madness, isn't it? That's what people say.
Right.
Talking to yourself is the first sign of madness. And I really puzzle about where that comes from, because it is such, to my mind, it's such a natural thing. It's such an important part of the minds that we develop, that we use language in this self-directed way. But there really is an interesting connection. I've been basically saying that our heads are full of voices,
right,
that our heads are full of dialogue, conversations with people who may or may not be there. I mean, it all sounds a lot like the kind of experiences that we associate with psychosis, so hearing voices, or, to use the technical term, auditory verbal hallucinations. These are experiences that are strongly associated with severe mental illness. So people with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, say, roughly 70% of them will hear voices. The experience is also associated with a whole range of other psychiatric diagnoses, everything from post-traumatic stress disorder to eating disorders to borderline personality disorder. A whole range of different diagnoses are associated with hearing voices. But it's critical to make note of the fact that quite a lot of people hear voices quite regularly, but are not distressed by them, they're not ill, they hear quite complex voices, quite developed voices. They can be annoying, they can be unpleasant, but they can also be positive and guiding and uplifting. And there's a fairly small proportion of people, as I say, who that applies to.
Yeah.
And then in the broader population, we reckon somewhere between 5 and 15% of people will have had a kind of one-off or a fleeting experience of hearing a voice. So a really common one that's happened to me is hearing your voice called and looking around, and it's hearing your name called, hearing somebody call your name. Looking around, there's no one there.
Huh.
Somewhere between 5 and 15% of regular people have had that experience at some point in their lives. So it is, yes, it's associated with severe mental illness because it can be really frightening and distressing, but it doesn't mean mental illness.
It's interesting.
So to go back to your question,
yeah, no, go ahead.
Why does anyone hear voices? The really simple theory, which I can explain very, you know, very quickly, is that when somebody hears a voice when there's no one present, what's actually happening is that they're producing some inner speech. They're talking to themselves. But for some reason, they don't recognize that they themselves have produced that speech. And so it's experienced as an external voice. And that's been a very powerful theory that we've been able to do a lot of work with, and it's led to some great research, but it is incomplete. There's much more to hearing voices.
It's fascinating, though. But, you know, it reminds me, having interviewed so many either novelists or artists, creative people will often describe, not always, but often describe this experience of being a kind of vessel for a character, almost like hearing the voice of that character. Does that make sense to you, Charles? And I think you've written fiction. Do I have that right?
That's right, yes. I've published a couple of novels, and so I do. I can.
You know what I'm talking about?
I can relate to this as a writer, but I think, you know, for our purposes today, is the interesting thing, I guess, is the psychological research that we've done. And we have an ongoing collaboration with the Edinburgh International Book Festival, which gives us access to lots of, you know, world-class writers who have been incredibly helpful in answering our surveys and conducting, you know, taking part in interviews and so on. And we find that the writers we've talked to, the majority of them, somewhere around 70%, if you ask them the question, do you hear the voices of your characters? In other words, do you hear them as if there's someone there with you? Around about 70% of the writers say, yes, they do.
Oh, that's fascinating.
That doesn't capture the incredible range of experiences that writers have. But they do hear the voices of their characters, and around about a quarter of them say it's as clear as if there's somebody in the room with them. And about 40% of them say they can engage in a dialogue with their characters. They can actually have a to-and-fro conversation with their characters.
Ethan, we're almost having a break here. Anything you want to add to that?
Just to reinforce what Charles said at the start, which is that, you know, these issues that we're talking about are by no means restricted to people who suffer from mental illness. Right. Yes, they can be very prevalent, but we see evidence for people having these experiences just normatively among people, just normal, healthy people walking down the street. And I think that's an important message to get out there, because there is this stereotype that only people with mental illness talk to themselves, and that's just not true.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Ethan Cross and Charles Fernyhough, and we've got Alexandra Horowitz waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about us talking to our dogs and cats and other animals that live with us. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about talking to ourselves, also known as self-talk or inner speech or private speech. But what about the conversations we have with the animals who live with us, telling them, you're such a good girl, or telling them about our workday, or using them as a sounding board for our problems? Well, the best person to answer those questions is cognitive scientist Alexandra Horowitz, who does research at Barnard College, has written a number of books about dogs, including Inside of a Dog and Being a Dog. Alexandra, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure, Marty.
So how common is animal talk, if I can put it that way?
Oh, I think it's ubiquitous, actually. And we're familiar with that kind of infant-directed speech that you demonstrated, which is directed and fed toward our dogs, the kind of baby talk. But the more I started looking, and this comes from someone who spends her life, you know, ostensibly looking at dogs, the more I discovered that, at least with dogs, we're regularly in conversation with them.
And do we know, I mean, even based on some of your research, what effect it has on a dog?
Well, I haven't looked at that per se, but from observational evidence, it doesn't have much effect at all on the dog. It seems to be largely about ourselves. And really based a lot on what the psychologists, including Charles, have written about inner speech. My best theory about sort of what we're doing in those episodes where we talk to our dog is that we're talking to ourselves as if in some way they're in our heads, which makes some sense, because animals, especially pets, domestic pets, are considered now part of the family, and they are, of course, the preoccupation of a lot of our thinking.
In fact, I saw that you referred to dogs as furry emojis, standing in for our feelings. And certainly, we generally, myself included, use probably a higher pitch, almost like a baby voice, talking to our animals. And they, especially with dogs, will cock their head or, you know, have some kind of physical, visual response to what we are saying to them. Does that, how significant do you think that is?
Well, it is the case that sometimes we use this kind of speech, this sort of, who's the sweetest doggy kind of speech, and that allows a dog who's familiar with the person to realize that maybe the speech is directed to them. If you think about it from the dog's point of view, you know, there's speech going on around them all the time, but only sometimes is it relevant for them. So that's a kind of marker that they might begin to pay attention. You're going to do something meaningful that involves them.
Do you, I know that you specialize in dogs, but I was just wondering, you know, I was sort of floating this out there. Do we tell our dog something different from what we might tell our cat or our horse or our turtle or our snake? Do we know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer. I think we've been talking to animals as long as we've been with animals. Maybe initially the record of our conversation with agricultural animals indicates that it was more instructional, the kind of come bitty, you know, come this way, do this thing. And that now that they're in our homes, it is a lot more conversational. The things that I've been observing are out in the street. I kind of eavesdrop, essentially, on people walking with their dogs and talking to their dogs, so I don't get that access to people with their cats.
Right, or their fish or whatever. Let me get our other two guests to weigh in on this. Charles, any thoughts?
I never had a dog, in fact, but I do have chickens. And I do talk to my chickens. I say all sorts of stupid stuff to them as I'm feeding them in the morning.
Do you use a special voice that you're not using on the radio?
I don't think so. No, I don't think I do a baby voice. But another aspect of my research has been about how parents talk to their babies, how they talk to their babies and their toddlers, where the idea that you, by treating another human being as if it had the full-blown consciousness, as if it had all the mental faculties that it, you know, he or she will ultimately have as they grow up, you can kind of create a context in which those faculties can emerge. So we talk to our babies, you know, often using the sort of high-pitched motherese kind of speech. Babies who, you know, even when they're way too young to really understand what's being said, or when they're still fetuses, and there's something about the way that we do that that seems to be important in enabling those kids to have those abilities further down the line. So it's not at all, you know, pointless and daft to talk to a being that can't yet appreciate what you're saying in terms of the words that you're using.
What are your thoughts, Ethan?
I think it's fascinating. I unfortunately have never had a dog or a cat, so I feel somewhat...
No chickens?
I had some cockroaches when I lived in New York City, but I didn't...
Doesn't everybody?
didn't talk to them, screamed. You know, one question is, you know, I wonder, do people vary in the kinds of things that they talk to their pets about? Mm-hmm. And because I could imagine that for some people... talking to an animal, a dog or a cat or a chicken, might serve a similar function to us trying to talk out loud to ourselves about some of our problems. But I could also imagine there being other things that people do in those cases with their pets.
Sure, the kind of third person that you were talking about. Alexander, you want to weigh in on that?
Absolutely so. I mean, I think really a minority is the kind of infant-directed speech that we think of when we think about talking to our animals. Mostly... it is as though we're in conversation, only the dogs never say anything. So it's a kind of one-sided conversation. What are you doing? You don't need to chew that. Put it down. Thank you. You know, it's a whole kind of as though there's a conversation happening. And then sometimes some are instructional, you know, as you'd expect, they're commands. But then sometimes I remember, for instance, an example where an instruction was totally ridiculous, that a man telling his dog to be a man, you know, and I think, well, you know, something interesting is happening there. It's something that's in their head that they're formalizing and saying out loud. They're kind of rhetorical questions. Am I still interesting? Are you reinventing the poo? I remember one woman saying to her long pooing dog. And then there's a kind of commentary that they'll do also, as though a parental commentary on a child's behavior. To imagine it's similar. Did you make a friend? you can't stop in the middle of the street. And these are said in a non-infant-directed speech way, as though it is a conversation only one-sided. And then sometimes people will also articulate what might be the dog's response. Do you want some of this? No. No. Oh, you don't? I really don't. You know, back and forth. And so miming both conversationalists.
And confiding in a dog. I mean, it seems to me that also happens, Alexandra. Confiding sometimes
absolutely.
Even deep, you know, deep emotional experiences.
Yes. I think we get to narrate our thoughts with this constant companion of ours. And we're assuming, I think that actually is the beginning of or part of all the things that we attribute to the animals as understanding of us. We've given them, you know, our emotional experience, and we expect that they're taking it in as a friend would.
Before we say goodbye to you, let me read an email from Bobby saying, I talk to my cat, but it's mostly about him, and he has me better trained than I'd like to admit. I apologize for taking him to the groomer after the fact. He somehow knows before, and we have a whole game of getting him into the carrier. So clearly there are a lot of conversations happening out there. Alexandra, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's Alexandra Horowitz. She's a cognitive scientist. She researches dog cognition at Barnard College and has written a number of books about dogs, including Inside of a Dog and Being a Dog. Staying with our guests for the rest of the hour, we do have some people that want to join us through email. An email from Catherine who says, I read recently that because people are on their cell phone so much, they have less opportunity for executive planning and for self-talk. What could be the potential positive and negative consequence of this increasingly lack of opportunity to unconsciously talk to ourselves? Very interesting. Ethan, have you thought about that before, and does it worry you?
No, I never thought about it in the context of cell phones. Cell phones and technology are obviously ushering us into a new way of living, and so the effects aren't just restricted to self-talk. I think the bigger question there is, what happens when our attention is chronically diverted to this machine and this information that can be really stressful at times? And I think that is very very worrying. And indeed, a lot of research is now going on to figure out how can you help people have a relationship with technology that's healthier. But, you know, one of the striking things as we've been studying self-talk that we find is that people tend to do it more frequently when they're experiencing stress and difficult problems. So that this capacity comes online in particular situations. And so I guess one reassuring part of all of this is that if you're stressed enough, this system might kick in and hopefully help in that way.
Charles, I remember years ago seeing someone walking down the street, and it appeared he was talking to himself, but he had a phone, you know, dangling near his ear. Now it's a very common sight, and it raises a whole bunch of interesting questions about self-talk, but also going from that silent inner talk to the more out loud speech. And I'm just curious about how you see this phenomenon.
Well, if you think about the developmental course of this kind of speech, you know, children are doing a lot of it, they're doing it out loud, then they go to school and they have to kind of be a bit quieter because it would be pretty difficult to run an elementary school classroom with 30 kids all chatting away. So there's that, and there's other factors. There are, if you are talking to yourself out loud, everybody else can hear what you're planning to do. There's, you know, good evolutionary and social cultural reasons why we take it indoors and do it silently. But more and more, I think the point about technology is that more and more we're recognizing that it's okay to turn it back outside again. You know, I talk to myself out loud much more than I used to do when I was younger, and it's partly because, you know, I'm a bit older and I don't care so much what people think of me. But I think generally speaking, for the reasons you mentioned, you know, everyone's talking to their phone, so what difference does it make to talk to yourself out on the street?
But for me,
the issue is not so much phones. It's other kinds of distraction that stop me thinking, that block my inner speech. And I think that's maybe what your emailer was getting at, that if I'm around music or other people talking or whatever, I can't, it sort of clogs up my my inner speech system, and I find it really hard to work and think.
Easier when it's if you're out in the countryside or just a quieter place?
Absolutely. Yeah. I just need silence, really, to do what I do. And anything really musical, people around me talking, I find distracting and it messes it up.
Yeah, Ethan, go ahead.
Yeah, I think we won't have enough time to get into this, but there is one other, I think, really interesting piece that comes into play when you think about technology, which is it's rapidly providing people with a platform to broadcast their inner speech. When you think about Twitter and other kinds of social media technologies, where you get the sense that people are often projecting what's happening in their minds to the world or their networks in ways that they wouldn't necessarily do if sitting face-to-face across someone else. And we're currently looking into this. I think this is a really fascinating way in which technology is altering the way our self-talk it functions.
Let me read an email from Pamela. And Charles, this is for you. She says, please ask your guests if they have any ideas about the voices that Joan of Arc followed. Mes conseils, she called them, which I think means, this is from Pamela, my counsels. Later, she said they were certain saints talking to her, but I think this was to please the church. You mentioned the fact that for some people they do hear voices, but they are not psychotic. What do you make of Joan of Arc?
Joan is an extraordinary story, very often mentioned in the context of the history of hearing voices. She would probably fit with our characterization of the voice hearer who is not troubled by their experience or not frightened or distressed by them. She's just one of many, actually, visionaries or people, famous voice hearers throughout history. Socrates was another example, and you can think of William Blake and Charles Dickens and Virginia Woolf and many others who found hearing voices a positive thing, a guiding thing. In Virginia Woolf's case, it was also a tragic thing because it contributed to her ultimate distress and her taking of her own life. But for many people, it's a positive and creative. And, of course, with the spiritual dimension that you've mentioned, it's an incredibly important part of how people make meaning of their lives.
Well, we don't have time to take Paul's question, but it's a good one. He says, is prayer similar to talking to yourself? And I don't know, Ethan, if you have looked at that, but it's an interesting thing to think about.
We haven't looked at it, but I think it was Desmond Tutu who once described this kind of self-talk as a conversation with God. That captures it, and I think there is a really interesting connection between what happens when we're in sanctuaries and praying to a deity and talking to ourselves.
Charles, I'm going to give you the last word, 30 seconds. What are your thoughts about that?
I think prayer is an interesting kind of inner speech, and I've looked at the sort of history of this way of communicating with a supernatural entity and the way it's featured in history and culture, and what a powerful force it's been.
Yeah. Well, it's been a really interesting conversation. Charles Fernyhough, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's a professor of psychology at Durham University, that's in the UK, and wrote a book called The Voices Within, The History and Science of How We Talk to Ourselves. Ethan Cross, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he joined us from the studios of the University of Michigan. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, director of their Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory. Also spoke with cognitive scientist Alexandra Horowitz. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.